From NPR and WBUR, I'm Scott Tong in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Jane Clayson in Boston. It's Here and Now. Federal research is now showing us just how bad the U.S. addiction crisis got during the pandemic. A new report from the CDC shows a record number of people, roughly 100,000, died of drug overdoses between April 2020 and April 2021. A majority of those deaths were caused by synthetic opioids like fentanyl. And making matters worse, people with addiction have struggled to get help as COVID stretched the country's healthcare system to its limit. For more, let's bring in Dr. Andrew Kolodny. He's the medical director of opioid policy research at Brandeis University. Dr. Kolodny, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
100,000 overdose deaths in 1 year. That's double what it was just 6 years ago. How has the pandemic contributed to this exactly?
It's hard to say. There's certainly a chance that opioid overdose deaths would have continued to skyrocket to the same extent had we not been hit with COVID. But there is evidence that COVID has made it worse. With the psychosocial stress and the social isolation, that certainly could trigger relapse in individuals with opioid addiction. And a few years ago, if someone with opioid addiction had a relapse or a slip, that would certainly be dangerous, but it probably wouldn't kill them. Now, with such a dangerous illicit opioid supply, all it takes is just one slip. We also have evidence that COVID may have made it harder for people with opioid addiction to initiate treatment. And lastly, there's also reason to believe that COVID may have led to more fentanyl coming into the United States.
Doctor, how has fentanyl changed the game here?
So with an illicit opioid supply that increasingly has fentanyl in it, we're seeing far more overdose deaths because fentanyl is many times more potent than heroin. So if fentanyl, for example, is being mixed into a batch of heroin and there's a little too much fentanyl in that batch, it's very easy for somebody to suffer an overdose.
Doctor, how should we be treating opioid addiction today in this country?
Well, the first line treatment for opioid addiction is with a medication called buprenorphine, which is prescribed long-term. There's also certainly an important role for treating opioid addiction with methadone maintenance. Unfortunately, many people with opioid addiction are unable to come completely off of opioids.
Well, the Biden administration is actually calling attention to $4 billion in the COVID relief bill that was earmarked for substance abuse disorders and mental health services earlier this year. From your perspective, is the administration doing enough? And are there approaches to treating this that are being overlooked right now?
$4 billion may sound like a lot, but it's not adequate for building out the treatment system that we need in the U.S. Money to a state to address the opioid crisis, one-time money or two-year money, it's very hard for the states to use that funding because if they hire staff, are they going to have to lay them off if that funding doesn't come through the following year? What we need from the Biden administration and what we need from Congress is long-term funding or new funding streams. During the AIDS crisis, the United States recognized that everyone who is HIV positive, regardless of their ability to pay for antiretroviral therapy, should have access to it. And we created the Ryan White funding stream. That's what we need to be doing for the opioid crisis. President Biden, when he was running for office, his platform for addressing the opioid crisis looked great. Unfortunately, he hasn't yet acted on his campaign promises.
I'm reading, Doctor, that we're actually on track to see a higher death toll this year in drug overdoses. Are there advances in the field of addiction that you're actually optimistic about, that you're looking forward to?
I don't believe that there are any opioid addiction treatments on the horizon that will really be game changers. We have effective treatments, but one of the most effective treatments being buprenorphine. Unfortunately, we don't have adequate access to that treatment. There are very few doctors in the United States who are eligible to prescribe buprenorphine. If we really want to see deaths start to come down in the short run, We have to make it much easier for people who are opioid addicted to access effective treatment than it is for them to buy a bag of heroin. And until we get there, until we make it easier to get treated, I think we're going to experience record high levels of overdose deaths.
Dr. Andrew Kolodny is Medical Director of Opioid Policy Research at Brandeis University. Doctor, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
The pandemic continues to kill more than 1,000 Americans on average every day. But according to a study published last month in the Journal of the American Medical Association, the pandemic death rate in detention facilities is twice as high as the general population. At the start of the pandemic, many prisons released people to ease crowding. But in Texas, state leaders redoubled their efforts to keep prisoners indoors. And now, a year and a half later, COVID-19 has turned Texas county jails into petri dishes of disease. And many of these already struggling facilities are near a breaking point. Paul Flav of Texas Public Radio reports.
Outside the Frank Crowley Courts building in Dallas, a half dozen people in masks hold up signs reading, "Where's our hazard pay and stop mandatory overtime?"
It's hard for us in here.
They say they're guards at the county jail, and many won't show their faces out of fear of retribution over their demands to improve working conditions and reduce overtime.
We are being mandated. We are tired. We don't have enough co-workers here.
This is Markeedra Benson, a guard in Dallas, on a video in the protest recorded by the website Smash the Topic in October.
We don't want to walk out. We just want to get the attention of the chiefs, commissioner's court, whoever, even other counties that can help us out.
Jails across Texas are struggling to keep their staffs, struggling with high inmate populations and with high COVID infections. Shorthanded jails in Dallas, Bear, Harris, and elsewhere are pulling patrol units off the streets at times to work in the jails. They're also forcing multiple days of overtime, says Detention Officer Emmanuel Lewis.
It was always the mandatory overtime. We were okay with the 2 days a week of overtime, but once it started to get excessive, 3, 4, 5 days a week, plus your regular shifts, it's way too much.
Lewis sued the Dallas County Sheriff over the working conditions in its jails. He says the sheriff and the commissioners weren't hearing guards' voices about how bad it had gotten.
At the beginning, we weren't even allowed to wear masks, and the staffing issues, and we were in up to 64 inmates in a tank where the ratio is supposed to be 1 to 48.
Two guards died in August, at least one from COVID. The Dallas County Sheriff's Office didn't respond to requests for comment, but the jail did fall briefly out of compliance earlier this year for not allowing inmates to shower or exercise. The jail is currently facing a federal lawsuit from inmates over health and safety. The pandemic didn't create these systemic problems, say guards across the state. It just made the cracks in the foundations of large urban county jails visible.
It's decades. This is a decades-long problem.
Robin Foster is a lawyer for the Harris County Deputies Association. The union is suing Harris County commissioners, its county judge, and the sheriff over the conditions there. Harris, home of the city of Houston, is the largest county jail in the state. The lawsuit is 200 pages of personal accounts from jailers talking about how every day their life is in danger. It is at times shocking.
We have detention officers who work 12-hour shifts and they can't get a break at all to go use the restroom. So they're using the restroom in plastic bags underneath their desk.
Foster says they need 500 detention officers to be hired today to keep up with the droves who are leaving the profession over concerns for their safety or for higher paying jobs. The lawsuit says there were 918 assaults on staff so far this year and more than 6,000 between inmates.
It's always been, oh, well, we just had, you know, the recession and then we just had Harvey and now we just have COVID. And it's just been trending down and down and down as far as working conditions.
The union has asked the federal government to take over the jail administration. Even though guards say the issues predate the pandemic, for some county judges, blame belongs with the governor.
Well, they've done just about everything they can to cause significant problems with local jails, particularly in the urban areas.
Judge Nelson Wolf runs Bexar County, home of San Antonio, and he says his jail is suffering because the governor and the legislature have made it harder to release people on bail, and that the governor's immigration enforcement has led to unprosecutable immigrants taking up space that should have gone to people at county jails waiting to start their prison sentence.
Very taxing. Mistakes are being made. Hard to get enough jail guards. Capacity is, reaching its limits.
The Bexar County Jail left a man incarcerated 5 months after he was court-ordered to be released. As Wolf noted, overcrowding is leading to mistakes. Bexar County adult detention was 88% full on October 1. On October 1, Harris County was 87% full, with more than 9,200 people. This number of inmates is hard to manage, according to Michelle Deitch, a senior lecturer on criminal policy at the University of Texas School of Law.
So it becomes an extremely dangerous environment if you can't separate people. And that's one reason we have to keep those numbers well below 85%.
Overcrowding won't improve in jails like Bexar County's until jury trials that were suspended for more than a year catch up. Bexar County is experiencing a historic 30,000 case backlog. Estimates are it will take a year to catch up. For Here and Now, I'm Paul Flav.
Julius Jones is scheduled to be executed this afternoon in Oklahoma. That is, unless the governor commutes it. The former youth basketball star was convicted of murder in 1999, but he's maintained his innocence throughout 20 years on death row. Jones spoke recently to journalist Mara Schiavacampo about his family.
I wish I was always here to protect them, comfort them, lift them up. But hopefully, man, you know, if I'm not here, they will remember, you know what I'm saying, that that was always my intention.
Gabrielle Kaplan is covering the story for Vice News, and she joins us. Hi, Gabby.
Hi.
Now, Julius Jones is set to be executed 4 p.m. local time in Oklahoma. Protesters filled the Capitol yesterday, calling on the state's Republican Governor Kevin Stitt to intervene. What is the latest from him?
So we haven't heard directly from the governor since the recommendation by the Pardon and Parole Board, but a spokesperson did say that he was, quote, taking his role in the process very seriously, and he is carefully considering the recommendation. His mansion has also been boarded up since Tuesday while he deliberates. And I just heard that Julius's lawyers have filed an emergency motion for an injunction based on the effectiveness of the lethal drugs.
And you mentioned the Pardon and Parole Board. What was their recommendation?
That his sentence be commuted to life in prison with the chance of parole, which would, of course, take him off death row.
Now, Jones was convicted of killing Paul Howell, who was in his car with his girlfriend and two daughters. They were in a driveway. Many have raised doubts about the conviction, including Paul Howell's girlfriend, some Republican lawmakers in Oklahoma, the parole board, as you said, recommending commuting this to life in prison. What is the case that Jones and his team are making?
So I covered this in a Vice documentary I co-produced last year where we interviewed his original defense attorney, and he told us that he regretted his performance during the trial and that he wishes he had done a little bit better. But Jones has other evidence as well that's mounting in his favor. He has an alibi that was never mentioned in the original trial, that he was at home with his family. The only eyewitness account of the description of the shooter, it didn't fit with Julius at the time of the murder. And Julius's conviction is based on snitch testimony, which has been historically unreliable in the U.S. with death row cases. There's also accusations of racial slurs used in the juror room and that the arresting officer used a racial slur. So that all led to the Pardon and Parole Board's recommendation. Yeah. They voted 3-1.
All right. Now, on the other side is the victim's sister and Oklahoma's district attorney. How did they defend the conviction?
Yeah, so Paul Howell's daughter has come forward last week saying that she believes, quote, 100% that Julius was the perpetrator. She also said that her and her family had met with Governor Stitt and that it had gone, quote, well.
Yeah, okay, and I understand the governor has met with the victim's family, but not defendant Julius Jones' family. You spoke to them, yeah? What have his family members told you?
Yeah, I've spoken to them quite a bit in the last few days, and they are frustrated, of course, with the governor's decision to reject a meeting with them. They've posted outside his office for several hours each day trying to get an audience with him, but have been rejected every time. And the family did visit Julius for the last time yesterday in preparation for his execution today. They said they couldn't hug or touch him and spoke with him through a glass wall, which they were quite frustrated over. They are, of course, praying for a different outcome, but they are very aware of the ticking clock at this point as he is set to be executed at 4 p.m. Central Time today.
And just a couple seconds remaining, this case has gained global attention. Can you tell us about that and whether this pressure is weighing on the governor?
Definitely. So there's been a huge increase in attention of the case, for the case. In the last few days, Kim Kardashian has been lobbying on his behalf. A petition to save him has gained 6 million signatures, and the EU ambassador for the US has urged him to halt the execution as well.
All right, Gabby Kaplan, Vice News. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
There are 10 new dragon babies in Texas. The San Antonio Zoo has announced it successfully hatched 10 Komodo dragons, which are the world's largest lizards. With fewer than 1,400 adults left in the wild, the event is also a chance to raise awareness about international conservation efforts. Craig Pelkey is director of ectotherms at the San Antonio Zoo. Craig, welcome to Here and Now.
Thanks for having me.
I understand you and your staff coordinated the logistics of the two dragons that bred. You incubated the eggs, and now you're raising these baby dragons. Tell us about the process of breeding and caring for Komodo dragons.
Well, the process starts with the recommended pairing from the Species Survival Plan, and we had to bring in the recommended breeding male from the Houston Zoo. So he commuted about 3.5 hours to do some dragon dating here at the San Antonio Zoo with our female, Christika. And we've learned to time it pretty well as far as season. Usually November and especially December. This isn't natural for what happens in the wild in Indonesia, but it works here in San Antonio. But that's kind of the breeding season, or at least the beginning. So we timed that to increase our success, and it worked out very well. Sometime in February, we started to just read their behavior, and we learned that they were done. I actually saw Christika looking a little plump in the belly, which was the eggs being produced. And then we started to see the signs that it was time to split them up. Being solitary animals, when they're all done with each other, it can get really scary. So we took Boga back to Houston by the end of February. And on March 8th, that's when Christika laid a bunch of beautiful white eggs. And from there, we pulled them for artificial incubation. And incubation, in general, lasts 7 to 9 months. Our first hatches began on October 17th. And the final baby hatched out 10 days later on October 27th.
And what was your reaction when you saw those eggs?
Oh, it's always exciting. It's just really freaking cool. Because taking care of dragons is... I've grown up loving dinosaurs, and this is like having a live dinosaur. And in fact, when I was 4, I used to page through my family's encyclopedia collection, and I looked at dinosaurs all the time, and I, of course, looking at Komodo dragons, because to me that was a dinosaur that was still around. And it was always a dream to be able to work with these dragons. And it finally came to full-time fruition when I came to the San Antonio Zoo in 2012.
Wow. Well, as you say, the Komodo dragons are native of Indonesia. And the picture you paint describes it well. I mean, they could be dangerous animals. They're gigantic, up to 10 feet long, right? And they're known for their hunting skills, their athleticism. So you've described the adults. Describe what these baby dragons are like.
Well, the babies, they're not very big. They're about, I'd say maybe 12, 14 inches. And in the wild, they are basically dinner for everything else, including other dragons, adult dragons. So they're a little skittish when they first hatch. Instinctively, they're looking for a tree to climb up and get up in a canopy where they're going to spend probably the next 1 or 2 years of their life in.
To survive.
Exactly. When you're a baby, you want to eat and you want to avoid being eaten.
So are your baby dragons, are they cute and cuddly, or are they already, shall we say, developing pretty quickly?
I find them cute and cuddly, but I'm a biased person towards reptiles. They're actually quite beautiful. They have very intense colors and patterns, which help with their camouflage in the canopy. I could go on and on about how they exhibit their intelligence, but our adults, they know their names, they know commands. It's almost like maintaining a dog in a dinosaur body. they have also a different personality. Some are outgoing, some are really curious. So we've already had some babies that as soon as they see us walk into the room, they're kind of clamoring to get access to us and they want to climb on us.
Mm. Well, the Komodo dragon is at real risk of extinction because of the impacts of climate change. They're also hunted illegally for their skin. And I read that the International Union for Conservation of Nature shifted the status of the Komodo dragons from vulnerable to endangered just a couple of months ago. Tell us why it's so important to pay attention to their plight and to advocate for protections for the dragons.
In the case of dragons, they are the apex predator. And they have a great role on the six islands they're from in Indonesia. And they help keep down the populations of wild hogs, Timor deer, and so on. Without them around to keep those balances in check, those animals would overpopulate themselves, become diseased, and they would have population issues. And in turn, they would start to destroy the botanical life that's on those islands. Mm-hmm. So those ecosystems really do need the Komodo dragon to help out with balance. It's almost like the wolves here in the United States. When we put the wolves back in Yellowstone, we started seeing balance in the form of other wildlife. We started seeing balance in the types of trees and other plant life. It's almost like things started being restored again.
That fragile balance of nature.
Yeah, everything plays a role.
Craig Pelkey is director of ectotherms at the San Antonio Zoo. Craig, thank you.
Well, thank you for having me.
All the best with your new babies.
Thanks, I appreciate it.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from BetterHelp Online Therapy, making professional therapy accessible, affordable, and convenient. BetterHelp offers licensed therapists who specialize in issues including depression and anxiety, as well as relationships, trauma, anger, and more. Connect privately with your therapist through live chat, phone, or video calls. Get help on your own time and pace, and at an affordable rate. For 10% off your first month of online therapy, visit betterhelp.com/hereandnow.
If you're on the hunt for your next DIY project, Apple might have one for you. Starting next year, the company will launch a self-service repair program. Consumers will be able to repair their devices using parts and tools provided by Apple. Apple has long been a strong opponent of customers repairing their devices themselves, but this latest move marks a change in the company's stance on the right to repair movement. Let's learn more with Robin Farzad. He's the host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure. Hi, Robin.
How are you?
Well, good. So how will this work for Apple users and what products will apply?
For now, John and Jane Q smartphone will be able to order original Apple parts to do their own home repairs. Initially for the iPhone 12 and 13 models, down the line for other units. You can also send back old parts for recycling. Still, Jane, there are lots of questions in the fine print. I mean, is your warranty voided? What will you be on the hook for if you give it a try and you find you have to relent and take it to the Apple store? the iPhone is decidedly not do-it-yourself, and you get the distinct impression that Apple here is not quite wholehearted about this.
Right. And in the past has been very resistant to repairs that happen outside of their stores, right? They've made it very difficult even for third-party repair companies to fix customers' phones. So what's changed, Robin?
Regulatory and shareholder pressure, the building right to repair movement. And one fund company in particular, Green Century, submitted a resolution asking Apple to reverse its anti-repair practices and make parts and tools more available. Apple, it should be noted, staked its entire comeback over the past 20 years over controlling its own hardware and software, the entire spectrum, the coveted Apple ecosystem. It's not open source as far as repair friendliness goes. I mean, whether you're talking about a median iPhone or one of those colorful iMacs from 20 years ago, these are kind of esoteric and difficult to open units.
So why would someone use this program as opposed to seeking out a professional in the first place?
Pride? Cost, maybe an unwillingness to just relent and upgrade as Apple expects us to. There are no shortage of YouTube hacks out there, but it's always been painstaking and precision demanding by design. And so you run the risk of damaging your hardware even more.
And so how much might this cost?
Not quite yet do we know of the full cost benchmark, but you will see all sorts of mom and pop places have to recalibrate what they charge, whether it's $100 or $200 to replace a cracked screen? Are they going to replace, you know, adjust their prices downward? Are the Genius Bar folks at the Apple Store going to change their fee and part schedule?
Hmm. So it's interesting. Could other tech companies follow Apple here? I mean, could others allow more at-home repair opportunities for consumers?
You know, everyone backed by Wall Street is wedded to the upgrade cycle, and you don't want to harm your repair network. It's a bit like General Motors depriving individual dealerships of the profit and recurring revenue of servicing a Chevy over a decade. I'm more curious, Jane, to see if this right to repair win emboldens Apple critics to take on some of its other money grabs, such as, you know, needless USB dongles and power adapter upgrades. You know, don't be so greedy, Apple.
Mm-hmm. Would you do it, Robin? Come on. Truth serum here.
No, I can't do it. Those things are impossible, and I'm terrified of annoying the phone company and Apple. I do live in fear.
That's Robin Farzad, host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure. Robin, thank you.
Thank you.
By now, you may have seen the Gosar video. That is Republican Congressman Paul Gosar posting an anime clip of him killing Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, a House Democrat. Yesterday, members voted to censure Gosar and strip away his committee assignments. The congressman, well, he doubled down yesterday in the House.
I rise today to address and reject the mischaracterization, accusations from many in this body that the cartoon from my office is dangerous or threatening. It was not. And I reject the false narrative categorically.
4 years ago, then-President Trump tweeted a similar video. It depicted him body slamming a man with a CNN logo on his head. So what's going on? Is our discourse cheapening? Let's put this all to Kathleen Hall Jamieson. She's professor at the University of Pennsylvania and director of the university's Annenberg Public Policy Center, where she founded factcheck.org. Kathleen, welcome to Here and Now.
It's good to be with you.
Now, we should note this incivility is a bipartisan phenomenon. Here's Congresswoman Rashida Tlaib 2 years ago speaking about President Trump.
People love you, and you win. Woo! And when your son looks at you and says, Mama, look, you won, bullies don't win. And no. I said, baby, they don't, because we're going to go in there, we're going to impeach the
So, Kathleen Hall Jamieson, is there something new and concerning here about our political discourse, or is this an old story?
Well, first, there's a qualitative difference between calling someone a bully and using profanity in relationship to them and showing a video depiction of that person being killed. But it is this something new? The genre is new. The ability to recreate visual content is new. The new technologies they've existed for some time in the recent past, but historically they're new. But let me take you back to something that is really important as we discuss this. When Jefferson set up the rules for the House of Representatives, these are the rules that govern the comitee, and that's with a T, comitee in Congress. Yeah. One of the rules says that you should not engage in personalities. In other words, you don't attack a person, you attack an issue. So under the rules of the House, it is inappropriate for you to engage in a direct attack on an individual. The purpose of Jefferson's rules was to keep the discourse civil and the engagement productive. Once you begin vilifying your opponents, or in this case, suggesting in a video format, in fantasy form, in animation, that it might be appropriate to knife them, bring swords to their necks, or behead them, because it is not constructive for a deliberative body to engage in personalized discourse that attacks the people that you're going to have to deal with on an ongoing basis.
Well, we have this Jeffersonian norm that you're describing, and yet we're seeing what we're seeing. Why? Is this social media? Is this the partisan echo chambers that exist in America today? What?
We've normalized the language of vilification in politics. And it is doing so by casting people who disagree with us as enemies, as opposed to people who have a philosophical disagreement, and then suggesting that they're evil. And once you suggest that someone is an enemy, and then that someone is evil, you can't trust their intent, and then that they are duplicitous, you can't trust what they say. You've basically fractured the ability to engage in discourse with them that might reach a compromise with them that might ultimately yield a common outcome. So the vilification of others has become a norm. And that's a relatively recent shift in the discourse of elected officials who are in public office. We've always seen that in the past in discourse outside that kind of venue. But we have a second change that is at play. We now have a capacity to diffuse content very rapidly to very large numbers of people. So content that might in the past have stayed within a small circle, language that you would have considered inappropriate, but it was bar talk, is now able to reach, in the case of the GoStar video, 3 million people.
Well, there's the political arena, and there's the bar vocabulary that you're talking about, and sometimes they intersect. Let's play a little bit of sound from a constituent of Fred Upton, Republican congressman. He got this voicemail after he voted for the Democrats' infrastructure bill.
Traitor, piece of piece of trash. Hope you die. Hope your family dies. Hope everybody, your staff dies.
I mean, this is, we can keep playing this. We know all of this is just out there now. It is one reason that for the people who are trying to do this, it actually accomplishes something. If they're trying to shake up something that much, it actually works for the audience they're talking to?
Well, first, it provides a cathartic release for the person who's engaged in the discourse. We now have means of reaching our elected officials. You can leave voicemail for elected officials. For example, go back to the 18th century and have to write someone a letter, or you'd have to find them in some public place. But there's something else that's going on here. Once we normalize a discourse in which it's appropriate to treat those with whom we disagree as enemies and to assume that they are evil and to assume that their actions are threatening us, and we begin to engage in a rhetoric that demeans them and dehumanizes them, it becomes appropriate then, if they are being cast as an imminent threat to our well-being, to say we're going to engage in violence against them. And so you move to a rhetoric of violence after you've engaged in those beginning steps. You're no longer engaging them as people who disagree with you and are people of goodwill and integrity with a philosophical difference. The next thing, that one reason we would say, is that they're that menacing, that evil, and they are an enemy. Shouldn't we try to eliminate them? The threats to eliminate come next. What you're seeing in the animation that the GoStar staff put together is the visualization of that reality. One of the reasons that we know that pattern exists is that's the way countries take their populations into war. You engage in those tactics against another nation and that nation's people in order to justify and in order to motivate the people who are going into war to kill the people who are on the other side.
So am I hearing that we should be concerned that these threats, this uncivil rhetoric, can easily cross the line into actually happening?
Yes, we should. And we should be concerned that we have normalized kinds of discourse that personalize, rather than dealing with the issue, attack the person, try to discredit the person, cast them as an enemy, cast them as evil, dehumanize them, degrade them, suggest they're menacing and threatening to us and our well-being in highly personalized ways, because that will lead to threats to engage in violence. And then, across the population as a whole, there will be some who will hear that newly licensed environment, that new norm, as the justification for actually acting.
And finally, how do you think about the long-term effects on democracy? You've clearly taken a long view of this, taken us back to Jefferson.
We have approached the point at which it is extraordinarily difficult for people who are in this kind of a discourse world to sit down at a table together, seated across from an individual they have cast as an enemy and as evil and dehumanized and argued is threatening and menacing to everything that the individual cares about. It's extraordinarily difficult for those persons then to engage in a process in which they deliberate, find common ground, and ultimately legislate for the common good. We're minimizing the likelihood that we're going to be able to find instances in which the Congress will come together as a whole to act in the national interest. And so this moment in time is not so much about that fantasy video or how we cast it, as problematic as it is, but rather this is an indication to us of a symptom in our broader culture that says we have so broken the discourse in which we talk politics that we may have made productive political engagement impossible at a time in which the nation is facing many issues on which we need collective action in order to accomplish real change for the national good and well-being.
Kathleen Hall Jamieson is professor at the University of Pennsylvania, and she directs the Annenberg Public Policy Center there. Thanks once again for your time.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
Buying a house these days is just ridiculously expensive, and on Martha's Vineyard off the coast of Massachusetts, it's particularly bad. Many mainlanders fled to the island during the pandemic, and a lot of them ended up staying beyond the typical summer season. As Wilder Fleming of WBUR reports, it's all contributing to a dire housing crisis there.
Affordable housing on Martha's Vineyard was already hard to come by, and the pandemic just made it worse.
The housing crisis that we face and we've continued to face, which is now escalated because of COVID and the increasing property values, has made it at critical mass.
That's Cheryl Andrews-Maltese, chairwoman of the Wampanoag tribe, whose ancestral lands lie in the town of Aquinnah. Aquinnah's year-round population grew by more than 40% over the past decade, and the island's five other towns have also experienced double-digit growth. According to the 2020 census, the vineyard's year-round population now exceeds 20,000. When the pandemic hit, hundreds of families who usually just summered on the island stayed for the winter. The median home price passed $1 million for the first time, and rentals for locals dried up. Andrews Maltese says some people have been sleeping in their cars, camping in friends' backyards, wherever they can find a place to spend the night.
There's no year-round housing, absolutely. Only a couple of towns have maybe one unit, and it's weekly rental or for the month. So our tribal members are being forced to move off the island, and not just our tribal members, families that have lived on the island all their life, and some for generations.
You know, we try and make light of it and say we want to move away. We don't like it here anymore. Is that why we don't feel so bad about having to leave?
Nuava K. Knight has lived on the island her entire life. She says she and her husband, a painting contractor, have been thinking about moving somewhere more affordable for years. The recent surge in new residents and housing prices finally convinced them it was time to go.
You know, before maybe we could still dream of being able to afford a teardown at $400,000, but now a teardown is $900,000.
The Knights and their toddler have been living rent-free on the summer estate of a Manhattan family in exchange for managing the property. Knight admits they lucked into a good situation, but depending on the goodwill of her employer is not a long-term housing solution.
This system kind of feels like a gilded cage these days, so we can't really, you know, make enough to do anything but work.
Now, the Knights have put money down on a house in western Massachusetts, where the cost of living is much lower. Knight will be the last of her five siblings to leave the island. And even long-term residents with stable housing are feeling the effects of the crunch.
When the median home price goes over $1 million, things change permanently. And it's, you know, it's heartbreaking. And it is the end of an era.
Laura Silber of West Tisbury has lived on the island since 1991.
We had this really thriving, vibrant arts community. Young people would come here, and you really could live here very reasonably. It was just wonderful.
Silber and others say teachers, healthcare workers, and other professionals regularly turn down job offers on the island because they just can't find a place to live. Plumbers, auto mechanics, even veterinarians are also scarce, and many essential services are delayed for months.
There will be no police officers and nurses and teachers and everyone, your gas station workers. How do you do that? How do you do that without housing people?
Ariel Faria is an administrator at the Edgartown Affordable Housing Committee. She and Silber are members of a coalition pushing to create a Martha's Vineyard housing bank. They're working with groups across the state to try to fund affordable housing through an additional tax on high-end real estate transactions. In the meantime, the island's six towns are trying to work together to solve the housing crisis. Jeff Crystal is a select board member in the town of Tisbury.
I think we have a lot of people who are very dedicated to the cause of finding
a solution, and not just the housing bank. I think we have our affordable housing committees that are doing it. I think we have planning boards that are meeting and discussing it regularly. We have selectmen who continue to push the agenda forward in all towns.
Crystal says he supports the coalition to start a Martha's Vineyard housing bank, along with relaxing some zoning rules that would allow for more building density. Laura Silber says the rest of the state should take notice of what's happening on the vineyard and in neighboring Nantucket, where home prices have also skyrocketed.
The islands are like the canary in the coal mine. I would advise other towns in Massachusetts, like, please don't wait till your median home price gets to $1.3 million, because you have so many fewer options once it gets here.
Silber says she has high hopes for statewide legislation that would enable cities and towns around Massachusetts to start housing banks of their own. But even if that moves forward, communities probably wouldn't see dividends for several years. For Here and Now, I'm Wilder Fleming.
And now an update on a story we brought you earlier this week. Historian Taya Miles has won the National Book Award for Nonfiction.
Yeah, and wouldn't you know it, Taya and I had a rich conversation earlier this week about her book that won. It's called All That She Carried, The Journey of Ashley Sack, A Black Family Keepsake. It's a story centered on a cotton sack handed down at the slavery auction block in around 1850. The bag goes through three generations of women, weaving together their lives, their love, their loss. Judges called it a brilliant original work, and you can hear our full interview at hereandnow.org. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Scott Tong in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Jane Clayson in Boston. It's Here and Now.